From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We haven't seen a GOP field this crowded in decades. 16 candidates are running after the 2016 Republican presidential nomination. Lately, a single over-the-top personality, Donald Trump, has dominated public attention. That's left others in the field struggling to find their voices and a path forward on issues like immigration that won't cripple the party's general election chances. This hour on Point, we'll talk with two Republicans trying to break out. Former technology executive Carly Fiorina, a long shot in the race, and Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who leads the polls in Iowa. You can join the conversation on air or online. Are Republicans addressing your concerns? Which of them can beat Hillary Clinton? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Now, later this hour, we'll be talking with Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. But joining me now from Los Angeles is 2016 presidential candidate Carly Fiorina, the former chief executive of Hewlett-Packard, the technology company. Carly Fiorina, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much, John. It's great to be with you.
Let me just start by asking, in a field with 16 candidates, you're one of the few who have not been elected to public office before. Tell me your path to victory in this race, how you see it playing out.
Well, you know, it's interesting, John. I have not held elected office before, but I'm certainly not a political neophyte. I worked as a surrogate for both McCain and Romney, ran my own Senate campaign in California, which is a huge state, as you know, and despite my loss...
I covered that campaign.
That's right. Despite the loss in the general election, I won more Republican votes, more Democrat votes, and more independent votes than any Republican running anywhere in the nation. That's how big California is. I've also chaired the advisory board for the CIA, advised two secretaries of defense, a secretary of state, a secretary of homeland security. I've traveled, lived, and worked all over the world, and frankly, know more world leaders on the stage today than anyone running, with the possible exception of Hillary Clinton, although she tended to do photo ops and I tended to do private meetings. But the reality is that 80% of the American people, we see this in, reflected in polls over and over, roughly 80% of the American people now believe we have a professional political class. People who've been in politics all their lives, all their careers, who are more concerned with their own power, position, privilege than they are with getting the job done. And unfortunately, I agree with them. We have festering problems in Washington. You know, you were just talking about immigration. For heaven's sakes, how long has the border been insecure? 25 years. How long have we had sanctuary cities? San Francisco's been a sanctuary city since 1989. How long has the legal immigration system been broken? 25 years. How long has the Veterans Administration been a shambles and a stain on our honor? Two decades. People talk about it. People give speeches. People take to the floor. Maybe they pass a law or two. But the truth is, it's not getting better. It's getting worse.
Your message
and
in that respect is...
The world is a more dangerous place.
Your message in that respect is quite similar to Donald Trump. He gave a speech the other day, and he said these candidates, they just run and run. They're wind-up dolls. They run in one election after the other, and they don't do anything. Are you making the same fundamental appeal that he is?
Well, I've been saying this since I launched my candidacy on May 4th. There's a big difference between talking and doing. And I have a track record of leadership and accomplishment. I also have a consistent track record about what I think and what I believe. And Mr. Trump has changed his point of view on some key issues over the years. And voters might want to look into that. I also...
Some Republicans tell me they think he's not really a Republican when you look at his history. Do you feel that way?
Well, you know, I spend less of my time talking about the other men in this race and more of my time talking about who we actually have to beat, which is Hillary Clinton or some other Democrat. I think it's going to be Hillary Clinton. But, you know, we've got a lot of folks in this race who spend a lot of time shooting at each other. I would prefer to talk about the fundamental differences between what I believe and what the Democrat Party believes. I prefer to talk about what I will do when elected president. And now, that message is resonating.
Now, let me ask you about communicating your message. You are a very effective communicator. How important is it for you to be on that debate stage next week, in fact, when Fox hosts the first Republican debate? As I look at the polling averages, and they say that from some combination of polls, they're going to take the top 10. You're not in it. How much does that matter to you?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Who knows how this is going to turn out, but there's a combination of polls where I most definitely am in, and there's a combination of polls where I'm not in, which sort of suggests that how you do the polling matters a lot. We know that, for example, when you have self-identified Republicans, they're usually not paying that much attention at this point. But I won't get into the vagaries of polling. What I will say is this. Of course, there's a forum in New Hampshire 2 days before. There will be many forums after August 6th. It's kind of interesting that this Fox News debate that Fox News and the RNC dreamed up in some conference room somewhere, I presume. Of course, I'd love to be on that stage. But it's interesting that if you looked at former presidential races at this point in the race, the polls, the pundits, and the money all would have said Jimmy Carter couldn't win, Ronald Reagan couldn't win, Bill Clinton couldn't win, and Barack Obama couldn't win. So while we're all lathered up about an August 6th debate, it's worth remembering that we have over a year to go here, and this is very early going.
Do you think this debate process...
a lot of people.
Do you think this debate process is wrong and needs to be changed? Would you, whether you're in or out, some people are going to be out and not be happy about it. Would you like to challenge the way that the networks are running these debates?
Well, you know, it's interesting. In my life, I've learned not to spend a lot of energy talking about things I can't do anything about. There's plenty I can do something about. Fox News has made their rules. I'm not going to change them. So I don't spend a lot of time worrying about what their rules are. I spend all my time focused on how many people can I meet today? How many times can I get on a radio show such as yours? It's why I appreciate very much, John, you having me on, so that people will hear what I have to say. I have the lowest name ID of anyone running. I haven't been in politics all my life. I haven't spent the last 10 years figuring out how to run for president. I am called to serve. And I think our government was intended to be a citizen government. I don't know when we got used to this idea of a professional political class, but I say all that because when I launched my campaign, the vast majority of Americans had never heard my name. And so I have a long hill to climb here. People don't know who I am, but I will tell you, when people do get to know who I am, when they have an opportunity to hear what I have to say, then people start paying attention. So I'm just going to keep talking to as many people as I can. I just came out of a week in Iowa. We had a fantastic week. I'm here in Los Angeles to give a major foreign policy address at the Reagan Library later today. And then I'm headed back to New Hampshire. So
let me ask you about running as a business person in the race, which, as I mentioned before, Trump is doing the same thing. He has criticized your business background, noting that you were, in his word, viciously fired from Hewlett-Packard, and that's not a good credential for being elected president. What do you say to him on that?
Oh, I've been very open about the fact that I was fired from Hewlett-Packard. I would agree with him. It was viciously fired in a boardroom brawl that played out over 2 weeks, but I'll run on my record at Hewlett-Packard all day long.
You're not offended by what he says.
Well, it happens to be a fact. Now, I will also hold my business record up against Donald Trump's or anyone else because I came into Hewlett-Packard during a very difficult time, the dot-com bust post 9/11, the worst technology recession in 25 years. It's taken the NASDAQ stock index 15 years to recover to its dot-com boom high. And yet, despite those tough times, we doubled the company to almost $90 billion in revenue. We quadrupled its growth rate. We quadrupled its cash flow. We tripled its innovation to 11 patents a day. We went from lagging behind in every market segment and every product category to leading in every market segment and every product category. And a number of competitors simply disappeared. I'm really proud of that set of accomplishments with the people of Hewlett-Packard. I will run on it all day long. And I started out as a secretary. Nobody handed me anything. A secretary in a 9-person real estate firm. I am enormously grateful because I know it's only in this country that you can start out as a secretary in a 9-person real estate firm, go on to become the chief executive of what I turned into, with the people of HP, the largest technology company in the world, and run for the presidency of the United States.
Let me ask you about another aspect of your California experience, and that is living in the state while when Pete Wilson launched the campaign in 1994 that was followed by mass alienation of Hispanic voters from the Republican Party. What is the California's experience with Pete Wilson, who won re-election with that campaign, by the way, but Republicans have not done well statewide since. What does that tell you about where the Republican Party is headed now and potential dangers there?
Well, first, just to correct you, I did not live in California in 1994, and I don't live
apologies.
In California today. No problem. I moved there when I was with Hewlett-Packard, and my husband and I moved back home to Virginia several years ago. I can't defend Pete Wilson on that point, but what I will say is I think that I know that Hispanics, all of them, whether they are citizens or not, are very concerned about issues that Democrats are on the wrong side of. Democrats are on the wrong side of education. The Democrat Party has been completely captured by the teachers' unions. It is Hispanic parents who, among others, sued the Los Angeles Public School District to give their children chances so their children would have choices about how to be educated. Those parents won in a court case against the teachers' union.
Carly Fiorina, please hold that thought. We're going to be right back in a moment. We're talking with Carly Fiorina about her bid for the Republican presidential nomination. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're talking with 2016 Republican candidate Carly Fiorina. Later in the hour, we'll hear from Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. Let me ask you about two ideas which Hillary Clinton has proposed in the last couple of weeks as a means of what she hopes will reorient the economy toward longer-term growth and higher wages for middle-class workers. One is to give incentives for firms to have profit sharing, more profit sharing plans for their employees. And secondly, a change in capital gains taxation that would push lower rates out for investments held for a longer period of time, 6 years or more, tax shorter term investments at higher rates with the idea that you want to not encourage quick profit taking, she calls it quarterly capitalism, but long-term investment. What do you think about those ideas, and what are yours for raising the vibrancy and the incomes of ordinary workers in this economy?
So now Hillary Clinton believes that the government should be telling companies how to invest their money and how to make business decisions every day, revealing that Hillary Clinton is and always has been a very left-leaning progressive who believes that government should be in the business of everything when the federal government is demonstrably inept at most everything it's doing right now, literally everything it's doing, including guarding our own secrets in the Office of Personnel Management. Look, we have to start by understanding how the economy works. She doesn't. I do. Here's how the economy works. The single most powerful engine of economic growth in this nation has always been small businesses, new businesses, startup businesses, family-owned businesses, and we are crushing them. So for the first time in U.S. history, we are now destroying more of those businesses than we are creating. Those kinds of businesses, the same one that I started out in as a secretary, a 9-person real estate firm, classic case, they create 2/3 of the new jobs, they employ half the people. So when we crush them, we are not creating jobs.
So tax cuts and less regulation?
We're not creating opportunities. Well, we now have a 75,000-page tax code. And you know who that benefits? Big companies, wealthy people. Big government favors the big, the powerful, the wealthy, and the well-connected. It's called crony capitalism. Big government crushes the small, the powerless, and the middle class. And that's what we're doing. And the irony of this is, of course, that Hillary Clinton, Elizabeth Warren, all of them, they say, oh, we need more big government to help the middle class. The truth is, the bigger government gets, the more crony capitalism reigns. You see it with Dodd-Frank, where the Wall Street banks have gotten far bigger and more powerful, and community banks are going out of business every day.
Let me switch gears for 1 second and ask you about a different kind of cronyism, and that's sex-based cronyism. You released a video recently, which was pretty entertaining. I want to play a little clip of it about what it would be like if men were treated like women in the office.
Well, we shouldn't have too many men on the project. You know how that can be. I'm assuming you two can work together without getting catty.
And then I said, well, I didn't know that.
Look at you being funny. I didn't know men could be funny.
Carly Fiorina, do you find that, have you encountered a great deal of sexism in your race for president? And secondly, what are the issues that you would offer, aside from sexism in general, as of particular interest to women Republican voters?
Well, you know, let's just start by saying that there is more opportunity available to women in this nation than anywhere else on the planet. You know, my story is only possible here. And let us also say that there are still barriers that women have to get over. And you see that, you know, when I was named the chief executive of Hewlett-Packard, I was the first woman to lead a Fortune 50 company. The stats haven't changed much in terms of the number of CEOs in the Fortune 500 or the number of women in the boardroom. And there's no doubt that women face a different level of scrutiny or criticism or subtle barriers in the workforce. I mean, women know that, men know that. I must say that as I have been out on the campaign trail, people are very open to my message. However, let me just give you an example. I was asked on a national television program on a Saturday morning whether I thought my hormones prevented me from serving in the Oval Office. Now, you know, a man isn't going to get asked that question. And what I now do frequently is I say to all the ladies in the audience, I say, ladies, can you think of a single instance in which a man's judgment might have been clouded by his hormones? And of course, we all think of millions of them, including in the Oval Office, by the way. So it's these sometimes subtle things. Yes, people ask me questions they wouldn't ask a man. But it's also true that in a recent poll, you know, 90%+ of the American people say they're perfectly ready and prepared to elect a woman president.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you about one thing that isn't subtle at all. I don't know if you've seen it, but New York Magazine has a cover out this morning showing 35 women staring at the camera. They call, and the cover says Cosby the Women. It's all the women who have accused Bill Cosby of assaulting them. You know, President Obama commented on this case the other day, and I wonder what your thoughts are on this cover, if you've seen it, and this case, even if you haven't.
Well, I haven't seen the cover, and certainly the facts and accusations are terrible and damning. And I think it would behoove Bill Cosby, a comedian that I've admired for a very long time. So, of course, I, like so many of his fans, are devastated by all of these revelations. I think it would behoove him to come out and tell people what he think happened. But it's certainly...
Would you believe him?
I don't know. I don't know. But I guess I still believe that... Look, I would never condone any of this behavior. I also believe that it's important to hear always both sides of the story, and I worry when people rush to judgment, and we do it all the time in this country. We rush to judgment. The media declares, I'm not defending Bill Cosby. Don't get me wrong, John. I'm truly not. I just, we tend to have a cycle in this country now where some revelation comes out, the media jumps on it, the media decides who's guilty and who's innocent. The president comments on it. He comments on those cases he chooses to comment on, and not on others, which I don't think is very helpful either, by the way. And then we all decide what the facts are before sometimes we have all the facts.
Do you think the fact that these women are speaking out now after so many years, does that, what does that tell you about the country's evolution on this issue?
Well, I don't know, honestly, John. I know you would prefer that I come up with some wise comment about the fact that we've come a long way in terms of women being able to step forward and reveal a scarring episode in their life. And I hope that that's true. I also think that, you know, the times were different in the 70s. And so it's hard for me to draw some huge generic conclusion, but I will say that I hope we have come to a place where people will respect anyone's opportunity to speak the truth. And I hope that we will always remember that in this nation, we're a nation of laws. We give people the opportunity to be presumed innocent until proven guilty. Again, I sound like I'm defending Bill Cosby. I'm really not.
No, I understand what you're saying.
We've all seen this movie before somehow, and the media has decided that Bill Cosby's going down, and so he may well go down on this.
Carly Fiorina is the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard and a Republican presidential candidate. She joined us from Los Angeles. Carly Fiorina, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Good
thanks
luck on the trail. Now, we'll be hearing from Scott Walker later this hour, but joining me now from Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, is Kim Alfano. She's a Republican strategist and president and CEO of Alfano Communications. Kim Alfano, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me.
And joining me from Atlanta is Nick Ayers. He's a Republican strategist, a veteran of presidential politics himself. Nick Ayers, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, John.
Let me start by asking both of you, first Kim and then Nick, assess Carly Fiorina's message and her viability as a candidate in this race.
Well, there's one thing you can't deny about Carly Fiorina. She's thoughtful without being contrived. She's conservative unabashedly. She really presents so beautifully, I think. And I believe she's right. It's early. And for someone with the talent that she has, I think there's plenty of time, if not in this first debate, for her to rise in the ranks. But what it also tells me is, look at Carly Fiorina and the field that we have this year, and then look at what we had in 2012. The quality of the candidates this cycle, while there are many, is so far head and shoulders beyond what we had in our last cycle. And I think for the party, that bodes very well.
Nick Ayers, given her intelligence, her ability to communicate, would it be a mistake for the Republican Party not to have her on stage in the first debate? Does it matter?
Well, there are going to be a lot of debates, John, and I'll let Fox News speak to that. And, you know, they and the RNC have worked that out, and there are a number of debates. And she'll, through programs like this and many other debates, she'll have an opportunity to make her case. I just say, I think Kim is exactly right. We have an embarrassment of riches in terms of the quality of candidates this cycle in the Republican primary. And frankly, if Carly Fiorina had run for president in 2011 and 12, she might have been the nominee. She's eminently qualified. I'd also say that if she had been as effective of a communicator as a U.S. Senate candidate in 2010 as she's become as a presidential candidate, she might have pulled off an upset against Boxer in 2010, and she'd be much better positioned now to win the nomination in 16. So she's an incredible communicator. That said, I don't see a path to the nomination for Carly because of the quality of the field.
Nick, we've got a call from your part of the country. Tom's on the line from Spartanburg, South Carolina. Tom, what's your question? Welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thank you so much. I'm in a very conservative state, South Carolina, and consider myself somewhat of a moderate. The issue for me and some of my friends, at least, is one of an environmental nature. So many of my conservative friends are fiscal conservatives and worry about the debt we're placing on our children for future generations. I worry about the debt we are placing on them for clean air, clean water, you know, recreational opportunities and that kind of thing. Is there any place in the Republican Party for people concerned about the environment? And do you think that would make a difference to swing moderates like myself more toward Republican?
Nick Ayers, what do you say?
I think the answer is yes. I mean, look, I always think it's kind of interesting that, you know, people who are conservationists, what is a very similar word? The root word of that is conservative. And I think that the media gets very focused on, you know, do humans contribute to climate change or not? And that becomes all the debate. But I think if you look around the country, particularly among Republican governors, you'll find that many of them have been the ones who have greatly expanded their state parks and poured resources into clean water initiatives. I know, you know, John, down in Georgia, we've been in a constant, you know, struggle with just water scarcity and battling with Alabama and Florida and others. And what we tend to rally around is a common interest in protecting what we have. And I remember when, you know, Governor Perdue was in office, a person I worked for, he and Governor Bush worked very closely on protecting the Apalachicola Bay. So I think it's less of an issue of protecting the environment and more about what is necessary to protect the environment. So I would say there's absolutely a place in the party for that discussion, and you will see that occur.
Kim, let me ask you to move beyond the issue of the environment. I think a lot of Republicans are looking at this field, 16 candidates, trying to make sense of it. How do you segment or bring into focus the choices for Republicans? You've got governors, current and former. You've got a few senators. You've got a couple of business people. How would you dissect the choice facing Republican voters?
Well, again, like
go ahead, Kim.
I was going to say that the choice is one of quality, like Nick and I have both been saying. You know, I have an affinity for governors and working with them. And I think they come in with an inherent advantage because they've been executives of their states. And I think they have very tangible, directly attributable successes that they can point to. It's harder for a senator or someone who's not in public life to point to some really distinct success when they're part of, you know, a big amorphous body that everybody hates. It's very difficult for them. So I would say, you know, when we get past the what has always happened in primaries, Republican and Democrat, the flash of the beginning of the personality flash that occurs at the very beginning, when we get down to actual records and issues, I think we have a solid bunch of conservatives, a solid bunch of thoughtful conservatives, the kind that can transcend to moderate and independent voters, yet still remain true to their conservative roots. And I think you're going to find the governors in that sense have an advantage. But I think, you know, like I said in the beginning, parsing this is a personality debate for a very long
right.
time.
Nick, Kim mentioned flash. Explain why Donald Trump has done so well in the polls. And is it conceivable to you that he could actually win the Republican nomination?
What voters are attracted to with Donald Trump at the moment is his candor. It's less about the substance of what he's saying and more about the style in which he's saying it. And look, that's a good strategy if you want to lead in the polls for a short period of time or a finite period of time. But polls this far out, John, as you know, are mostly irrelevant.
Can he be nominated?
Well, hang on. As the election nears and the caucuses near, so will voters' attention span. And I suspect that his actual record in a Republican primary will be severely challenged. But look, I for one, don't mind his candidacy. My view is if our tier one candidates can't beat Donald Trump, what makes you think they can beat Hillary Clinton?
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with 1/8 of the crowded field of candidates for the 2016 Republican presidential nomination. We just heard from Carly Fiorina. In a few minutes, Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin. With me once again are Republican strategists Kim Alfano and Nick Ayers. Guys, I want to take a call. We've got Tim on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Tim, welcome to On Point, and go right ahead.
Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call. My question is for both of your guests, and I'd just like them to comment on every time I listen to the Republicans, they're always, less government, big government is evil. And I'd just like them to comment on, I understand that, but at the same time, every time I hear things about marriage equality and abortion, they seem to be for more government. And could they comment why the Republicans seem to want to be less government for business, but more government in our bedroom? And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Thanks so much for your call. Kim, why don't you start?
Well, I think you'll also find that they say let states and localities decide these issues. And I think that's a consistency from the federal government on down. I think the point that Republicans constantly make is we should be able to live and legislate and have our lives guided by the things that we vote for and want and not be determined by some amorphous federal body who decides that they want to be in charge of our lives. And I think you would be hard-pressed to say that the entirety of the Republican Party wants anything more than to have those decisions made at a local level.
All right, I want to take another call. We've got Jay on the line from Malden, Massachusetts. Jay, welcome to On Point. Go ahead.
Hi, John. I'm curious to know whether your guests think that it's possible for a moderate Republican to exist and to win in an era where extremism seems to get the news and seems to get people riled up enough to be interested in the elections. And if so, are there any kind of truly centrist candidates in the Republican Party today?
Jay, thanks so much for your call. Nick Ayers, what do you say?
Yeah, I mean, I just find that I don't want to insult his intelligence, but I almost find it laughable. There's only one party that doesn't tolerate moderation anymore, and that's the Democratic Party. If you're not in lockstep with them on social issues, you're not allowed to speak at the convention. You look on the Republican side, you get a wide variety of candidates for president, but also candidates for U.S. Senate, candidates for governor, who represent, I think, all views of American conservatism, whether it's extremely conservative or moderately conservative. Just look at people like Mitch Daniels, who played a huge role in getting him elected, and one of the most effective governors in my lifetime in America. He's a very moderate person when it comes to social issues. Governor John Huntsman of Utah, who ran 4 years ago, very moderate on social issues, quite conservative on fiscal issues. So I think our candidates reflect both candidates at all levels of office reflect a wide view on social and fiscal issues, and there's really only one party, and that's the Democratic Party, that really won't tolerate anything but the ultra-left.
Nick, speaking of Republican candidates, we've got one on the line right now. Joining me from Godfrey, Illinois, is Wisconsin Governor, Republican presidential candidate Scott Walker. Governor Walker, welcome to On Point, and I hope you don't take the fact that I'm a Duke guy, hope you don't hold that against me after the championship game this past year.
We're happy to be there and happy to have beaten Kentucky after losing by 1 point last year in the Final Four. We actually got to the championship game. So we like Coach K, even though we obviously would have loved to have a national championship. We got to have a little fun. That's right.
Governor, let me ask you, 16 candidates. I think a lot of Republicans may be overwhelmed or confused by their choices. How would you make clear to the Republicans listening to this show what makes you different, why they should support Scott Walker?
Yeah, well, you're right on the number. Pretty soon it'll be easier to keep track of which Republicans are not running than those of us who are. But I think what makes us unique is there's a great field, many of whom are good friends and people I've worked with over the years, so you're not going to hear me attack the others. What I think it makes us unique, though, is there's really two groups. There are fighters and there are winners. There's a lot of people fighting in Washington, fighting the good fight, trying to contrast their point of view with that of the president and others in Washington. But they largely haven't won those fights. And then there are winners. There's a number of people who've been very good at winning elections and getting reelected. But for the most part, they haven't been in the fight, at least the fights that matter over the last few years. And I think what makes this unique, not only to Republican voters, but I think just to Americans in general, particularly amongst independents, is that we've done both. We're the only candidate in the field that has consistently done both. We have fought, and we have won. And people's lives are better off because of it in Wisconsin. It's part of the reason why I've won 3 elections in 4 years in a state that hadn't gone Republican for president since 1984, winning almost unanimous support amongst Republicans, the full spectrum Republicans, but also carrying independents by 11, almost 12 points. Because in the end, independents want a lot of what the base Republicans want, is they want people just to look them in the eye, tell them what they're going to do, and then go out and do it.
Well, let me ask you about how you define victory, because the candidate who improbably has commanded so much attention lately, Donald Trump, who has been very successful in business, phoned into one of the Sunday talk shows yesterday and said that you had been, or that Wisconsin was a catastrophe after your leadership. What do you say to him?
Well, one, I'm going to let Donald Trump speak for Donald Trump. I'm not going to attack other candidates. What I will tell you is I'm proud of our record in Wisconsin. It's why the voters in my state, a blue state, elected me 3 times. We took a $3.6 billion budget deficit we inherited, and we turned it around, in fact, so much so we actually were able to lower the burden by some $2 billion in our hardworking taxpayers on individual rates, on employers, most importantly, on property taxes. Property taxes today in my state are literally lower than they were 4 years ago when we started. My rainy day fund's 165 times bigger than we took office. My pension's the only one fully funded in the country. Now we've got our finances and our economy back in shape. Our state had an 8.1% unemployment rate before I took office. It's down to 4.6%, well below the national rate. The rate at which people are working, the labor participation rate, is about 5 points higher than the nation. And things are working better. Our schools, for example, second highest ACT scores in the country since I've been governor. Graduation rates are up. Third grade reading scores are up. Speaking of second best, our hospitals, our healthcare systems are ranked second best in the country. We restored the raid on our transportation fund. We have done one positive thing after another.
But Governor,
our state is that much better off because of it.
I think you would acknowledge that as a matter of current politics in Wisconsin, you are not at high tide. John Kasich, your fellow Midwestern governor who got in the race the other day, sent out a release the other day that said, comparing the approval ratings in their states of governors. He's at 60 in Ohio. He said, you're at 40 in Wisconsin. Why isn't that a pretty good endorsement for his viability on a national basis as opposed to yours?
Because the big difference is the only poll in life that matters is the one taken on election day. I faced the first recall election in the history of the country where a governor was reelected, and I was actually reelected by a larger margin than I was the first time. At that point, the point that we're at right now, 4 years ago, in the beginning of 2011, my approval rating was somewhere in the 30s because I was under massive attack from every left-wing group you can think of in America. And in the end, the reason why we won with a higher percentage of the vote and more actual votes in the recall than we did in the general election was because our reforms actually worked. We were willing to take on the big challenges, turn the economy around. People saw their schools were the same or better for the ones that used the reforms. They saw after a decade of 27% increase in property taxes, the property taxes actually went down. And so, yeah, I could probably pad the score if I didn't take on really big challenges. But I think Americans, just like the people in my state, want leaders who are willing to take a risk, want people who are willing to stand up and think more about the next generation than just about the next election. And I think that's why you've seen not once, not twice, but 3 times in a blue state, we've been elected by not just Republicans, but by a majority, a strong majority of independents.
You mentioned
we've shown that people want leadership.
You mentioned the economy. Let me ask you about that. Hillary Clinton, who appears likely to be the Democratic candidate, has essentially placed at the center of her campaign an effort to raise middle-class wages and shift the economy toward more long-term growth and productivity. A couple specific ideas in the last few weeks, more tax incentives for more profit sharing for workers, shifts in capital gains taxation so that if you want the lowest rate, you got to hold the investment for a long time. She thinks that'll make people focus not just on short-term stock prices, but the long-term. Is she right about the problem, middle-class wages? And if so, is she right about the solution, and what are yours?
Well, the middle of the economy has been suffering under this president and this president's policies. The irony is Hillary Clinton talks about it, but where in her career, she was in the United States Senate, she was Secretary of State, what can she point to where she has consistently fought for hardworking taxpayers in this country? In contrast, we've actually fought and delivered on it. We've lowered property taxes, which are one of the areas that affect working families, senior citizens, small business owners, family farmers the most. We've lowered property taxes 4 years in a row in my state. I've lowered the tax burden on the middle of my bracket to a much greater effect than anywhere else. We put in place worker training and skills programs to help people get the skills and the education they need. And nationally, I think instead of going down the path that Hillary Clinton has, which is the typical agenda of those on the far left, instead of talking about how low wages are, let's talk about how we get people the skills and the education and the qualifications they need to succeed in life in careers that pay hopefully two or three or four times or more the minimum wage. And the best way to do that is take money for education and workforce development, and instead of having it eaten up in the federal bureaucracy, send that money back to the states, send that money when it comes to education back to our schools, where it's more effective, more efficient, and definitely more accountable to the American people. That will truly help increase wages as we help people get the skill sets and the education they need to succeed.
Governor, let me ask you about a foreign policy issue that is partly about foreign policy, but also about tone. I saw your op-ed in which you said that you would terminate the Iran deal if you were elected president. But Mike Huckabee, former governor of Arkansas, who was a successful governor, went way up the ante on you by saying that, in fact, with this deal, that President Obama would march Israel to the door of the oven. What do you think of that rhetoric, and why is that kind of talk prevalent in your Republican contest?
Well, as I said about Mr. Trump, I'm not going to comment on him or Governor Huckabee or anybody else in terms of their policies. I'm going to let them speak for themselves. I'll tell you what I'm for and what I think needs to happen. I believe firmly that we need
to... You don't want to condemn that comment, though?
Well, I'm not certainly not going to say it, but I'm telling you, they can speak for themselves. I'm going to tell you what I'm for, and you're not hearing me use that sort of language. What I'm talking about are the issues and the specifics, and in this case, when I talk about the Iran deal, remember Iran, this is a country I can still remember as a kid, my brother and I tying ribbons around the tree in front of our house in a small town we grew up in, Delavan, Wisconsin, during the 444 days that Iran held 52 Americans hostage. Iran has not substantially changed its rhetoric nor its oppressive government since that time. This is not a country we should be doing business with. I would terminate the deal with Iran on day one. I would reimpose the congressionally authorized sanctions. I would work with the Congress to put in place even more crippling ones. And I would convince our allies to do the same. And I wouldn't wait till the first day. I'd be on the phone on the day after the election working with our allies around the world, because Iran is not just a long-term threat because of their illicit nuclear infrastructure. They are a short-term threat for sure to Israel, because much of this money that's going to come from the lifting of the sanctions isn't going to go to help the Iranian people. Lord knows they could use some help there. They're not going to get it. Overwhelmingly, it's going to go to support terrorist-related activities around the world, much of which will go to Hamas and Hezbollah on either side of Israel, as well as going to their other activities, which are propping up Assad in Syria, supporting the Shiite-based militias in Iraq, and doing things like supporting the Houthi rebels in Yemen. Those are all bad things for the region, for Israel, and ultimately for the United States.
Scott Walker is the governor of Wisconsin and a Republican presidential candidate. He's joined us from Godfrey, Illinois. Governor, I know your time is short. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Glad to be on.
And now we'll go back to Kim Alfano, the Republican strategist, and Nick Ayers, who've been with us throughout the hour. You critiqued Carly Fiorina's message before. Nick, let me start with you. Scott Walker, effective communicator, good shot at the nomination?
Absolutely. So I think Governor Walker's well positioned to win the primary. He's one of the few candidates who I think has a very good chance to compete in all the early states. You get many of these candidates who are limited to, you know, they're sort of focused on Iowa or focused on New Hampshire. With Walker's record of governing and his effective nature as a campaigner, he's one of the few I think who can compete in all the early states. He's not isolated either Iowa or New Hampshire, as many are. And look, Scott Walker wins, and he wins a lot. He's racked up 4 major statewide wins in 5 years in a very difficult state for the GOP, and he didn't do it by making concessions on his conservatism.
Kim, do you agree with Nick?
100%. I would say, you've had one of my two favorite your guests are two of my favorite communicators in this pack. Scott Walker is so naturally talented when he speaks to a camera, when he speaks to a crowd. As Nick mentioned, I work with Mitch Daniels. He has that same air of knowledge without arrogance. Just love listening to him speak. And he's
let me ask both of you,
without jamming it down your throat.
Speaking of that, conservative without jamming it down your throat, a quick assessment from both of you because we're running out of time. My assumption has been, continues to be, and I see from the polls it's that of a plurality of Republican candidates, that Jeb Bush is still the most likely Republican nominee. Do both of you agree with that or not?
I'd say it's 50-50 with Walker.
Nick?
Yeah, I disagree with that. I think it's a jump ball between about 5 or 6 candidates.
Nick Ayers is a Republican strategist. He joined us from Atlanta. Nick, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Kim Alfano is a Republican president and CEO of Alfano Communications. She joined us from Delaware. Thank you, Kim, for being with us.
Always, John. Thanks.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, the United States and Africa. What we see in and beyond President Obama's big visit. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.